Welcome to the Disruptive HR Podcast. If you want to do HR differently and are looking to improve your skills and influence, why not check out our website, disruptivehr.com. Hi, and welcome to another podcast from Disruptive HR with me, Lucy Adams. And we talk in this podcast to people who are in the HR profession and who are disrupting, or people who are around the HR profession and adjacent to the HR profession, which is the expression everyone's using now, and who are disrupting it and doing things differently. And today, I'm talking to Kirsten Ferguson, and Kirsten Ferguson and I met in Brisbane in August, so earlier on this year, and we just connected, didn't we? It was a bit of love at first sight, I think.
Well, you were heavily jet lagged, so
tell me about it. I'd like literally got off the plane and straight into this panel discussion that you were hosting, and I basically stayed jet lagged for the entire time and then just came back and just slotted straight back into jet lag here. But we connected because I think we have similar ideas about people and people development and also leadership. And you are an award-winning leadership expert. In fact, when we met up again in London, you had just won the award for like the world's best person or something. I can't remember. It was like the highest
that
award.
That was exactly what it was called. No, it was the Thinkers 50. I was ranked in the Thinkers 50 list and won their leadership award, which when we saw each other. So we had a celebratory drink.
We did. And you were over in London to promote your latest book. And that's what we want to going to talk about today, because I think it's absolutely fascinating. I've got it here for those that you are watching this on video, Head and Heart, The Art of Modern Leadership. And I suppose the key thing for me is kind of why write another leadership book? I mean, how many are there of them out there?
I think I put in the introduction, there's 60,000 on Amazon at the moment, which, you know, that is the definition of a crowded market. And probably there's not much new that can be said about leadership. But, you know, I'm a sucker for punishment. Lucy, I feel passionate about it because I think many leadership books I've read anyway either are written by someone who's been a leader and write almost a memoir of the anecdotes of their own leadership approach, which may or may not work for anyone else, or they're an academic who perhaps have not led anyone in the real world ever. And I feel really fortunate to have done both. So I've been a leader myself for more than 30 years and started in the military. Then when I did law, became CEO of a consulting firm and have sat on company boards for more than a decade. But I've also got a PhD in leadership and write books and have a weekly column in our major newspapers here in Australia. And so I'm passionate in believing that research has a place in understanding where we can go. And so this book for me was a real mix of my own head and heart, if I can use that metaphor as many times as possible during this podcast, because it, you know, my heart has told me that as a leader, it's bloody hard. It's difficult leading. You know, there's just so many things that can go wrong. And with all the best intentions as leaders, we make mistakes and find that, you know, we're not having the impact we want to have. But my head tells me, you know, there's also ways that we can work on that and how we can bring that together. And so that's what I hope the book does.
I mean, I think it does it brilliantly. I'm not a great fan of business books or leadership books. As you say, they either tend to be way too heavy on the research and it's like, oh, come on, or so anecdotally based that it doesn't give you the so what. It doesn't give you the way forward as a leader or an emerging leader or somebody who's aspiring to be a leader. You want to some tips and tools and very practical things that you can do. And I think your book definitely offers both. So it's a great read, as well as being incredibly insightful and robust. You know, it's robust on the data. Just give us a thumbnail of what the book's about and what are the key messages. If you were kind of saying, I want you to take away two or three things about the book, what would those be?
All right, let's keep it to two, just to keep it simple. It's late in the day for me, early in the morning for you as we're recording this. But the first one is that everyone's a leader. And when I first sort of wrote that, and a lot of the book is focused on talking to leaders who aren't our traditional organizational formal leaders, it seems really trite to say. I mean, it's easy to say we're all leaders, but most people don't realize the leadership impact they have in their families, in their communities, or in their roles, even if they're not in a formal leadership position. And I think those of us who are, particularly those in HR, but others with formal roles, can be reminding everyone that they're leading and they have an impact in whatever it is they're doing. And I really believe that leadership's simply a series of moments, and that every moment is an opportunity for leaving a positive impact. And so that's the first message, that this is a book for everyone. The second message is really about what it means to be a modern leader. And this is where I do draw on my research. I developed a scale called the Head Heart Leader Scale, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But that is basically, it creates a framework of a metaphor. Clearly, head and heart's a metaphor, but we all intuitively understand what it means. And I believe that the art of modern leadership is knowing what is needed and when. It's really understanding that we need both our head and our heart, and all the attributes, there's four attributes for each, both need to be balanced and drawn upon as required. And that really is the art of a modern leader. And so the bulk of the book is really talking about what those attributes are and what they look like, how you can build them in others, and how we can build them in ourselves.
And are there any kind of, when you talk about the modern leader, you're talking modern as in post-COVID or 21st century? What's your kind of definition of modern?
Well, to me, it's right now. It's 2023. So yes, that's both 21st century and post-COVID. It's really that leader that's, I mean, I'm hoping your listeners are robust. They are HR professionals. It's not the dinosaurs and the dickheads that we tend to work with. So it's everyone but the dinosaurs and the dickheads, I think, are capable of being modern leaders. And, you know, there's a lot of dinosaurs out there that don't think they need to change how they lead, that believe that command and control is the way and that their title gives them all of the authority that's ever been required. There's also a lot of dickheads who think they're the smartest person in the room, that don't need to ask questions or be curious. And, you know, they're people that I think modern leadership is pushing out at the edges. We know who they are. They stick out like a sore thumb. And I know from sitting on boards, chairing remuneration committees, nominations committees, that we're not looking for CEOs like that anymore. Yes, of course, there's exceptions and we see them every day, but they also tend to be associated with scandals and reputational crises and everything else that go on in organizations. So a modern leader is someone who really understands that they have an impact on those around them through their words, their actions, their behaviors, and they understand that every action is going to leave either a positive or a negative impact, and they're really focused on making sure it's a positive one.
It's good to hear that you think that those dinosaurs and dickheads are gradually being phased out, because I think speaking as a member of the HR community, so much of what we have done and what's occupied our minds, our energies, our talents, our resources has been compensating for poor people leaders in particular. And it's created this kind of codependent relationship where we are, you know, placing people into leadership roles who, some of them shouldn't be anywhere near people, let alone, you know, a proper leadership role. And yet we're stuck with them. And so we spend our time trying to train them and, you know, kind of get them to do remedial courses to get them to be better. And if we spent as much time making sure they didn't get into those roles in the first place, I think it would make our lives a hell of a lot easier.
And I think that's very true. Look, I mean, I'm not going to say that every organization has seen the light, that's for sure. And it's a cultural thing. If you've got a dinosaur or a dickhead running your organization, you've probably got a whole tribe of them within the culture. But I do think there are organizations that recognize it's not a sustainable way of leading organizations. And I've had two conversations just today about working with organizations on how they can recognize that some people who are technically particularly brilliant industry leaders shouldn't be allowed near people. So we need to find a role for them in the organization. Absolutely. That really helps them to thrive and helps the organization to thrive. But those leaders who are sometimes hidden in, you know, deep pockets of the business, but who love leading people and are absolutely those informal leaders everyone goes to anyway, finding ways to support them to actually have a more formal leadership position. And I think, or I hope, I'm an optimist. I hope that's the direction we're moving in.
And I think you're absolutely right that it's not a question that the people who are perhaps the biggest single contributors, technically unbelievably gifted, that they don't get promoted. It's just that the only routes for promotion have typically involved inheriting large teams of people. And as we know, you know, the leaders who are going to thrive in this disrupted world, the modern leadership challenge, are not those who are the biggest, who are stronger than everybody else, more resilient, biggest single contributor. It's about, can I get the team that work for me to do their best work? Am I enabling them? That's my priority. And so few of them still, I think, kind of get that or get any sense of value from it. Any sense of, you know, they don't derive their sense of who they are from developing and enabling others.
Because we're requiring in that scenario, which I fully agree with, to be a servant leader and to understand that actually you're not the reason that these people exist. You are just there to facilitate helping them flourish and thrive. And, you know, it's very few leaders that are rewarded and promoted and given pay rises on the fact that they're humble servant leaders.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's have a look at my score. So you mentioned that there is a diagnostic, and we all love a diagnostic, don't we? It's just a super smart way of getting the book to people, I think, is that idea that we get to look at who we are.
We don't say that out loud, Lucy.
It's great. It's a really super thing to do.
I just looked, more than 19,000 people have done the scale since the start of the year.
Which again gives you further great research, doesn't it?
So it is, and I am continually researching the data. So for anyone listening, while we're talking, go and visit headheartleader.com.
Yeah, and definitely do the assessment. And I did my assessment, and
it's free, by the way. You should point out it's completely free.
Absolutely, completely free, and it's very easy to do. And what came back was that I'm pretty strong on the heart side. So you can talk us through the different categories. But slightly worryingly, I'm not thick, am I? On the head side, it seems to be slightly lower than the norm.
I'm
slightly
worried. The word I would use, you know, the HR profession. I'm hoping you don't do performance reviews and go, you're slightly thick. But you know, let's move on from that. No, okay. Well, let's give everyone listening a bit of an idea. So I spoke about the head and the heart, and we need all of these attributes. There's four attributes of leading with the head, and these are all the things we're most comfortable with, because we can measure them and package them up and put them in a policy. And it's all those things those technical experts do pretty well at. Curiosity is the first. I'm sure we'll talk about some of these in more detail. Wisdom, which is around decision-making. Perspective, which is about reading the room. And capability, which is really linked to a growth mindset and not just being capable in what you do, but believing you are as well. So they're the four head ones. Most people are pretty comfy there. The heart-based attributes are humility, self-awareness of the impact we're having on those around us, courage to speak up for what we believe in, and empathy. And when you do the scale, it'll show what your scores are against a sample group of about 1,000 people or other leaders that I did this with one of the universities here in Australia. And so looking at yours, Lucy, you definitely over-index on the heart side of things. So while your number one attribute is a heart-based attribute, it's self-awareness. So that means you are very aware of the impact you're having on, you know, those around you. You're aware of your character and your abilities and your limitations. So being aware of our limitations was one of the most important questions of the 24 in the scale, to recognize whether or not you're a modern leader. Although I've just given away the key that I'm not
everyone's
going
to be marking themselves high on that
one. When you get to that question, you know it's important. We haven't got to your lower ones yet.
No.
So you're very strong in the heart-based attributes, and that does not surprise me, knowing you and knowing the work. And while we've got an HR profession listening, it's important to remember for the HR profession, often you over-index on the heart. And I'm going to say to you what I say to groups of engineers who are the reverse. Both are unhelpful. You need to have balance. So it's all very well for us to be talking about the technical experts that are traditionally, you know, the CFOs and the engineers. HR, you guys are just as liable to fall into this trap, but on the heart-based side. So if we look at your head-based attributes, these are where, you know, there's areas for you to focus on, opportunities, isn't it? What are all the catchphrases?
Yeah, all the buzzwords, Development opportunities.
For development. There's one I want to pick on, though, and it's perspective. So in my research, it was of all 8 attributes, the one that correlated most highly with being a modern leader. Basically, if you score high in perspective, you're likely to score more highly in all of the others. And what it is in layman's terms, reading the room, but you're not just reading the room, you're noticing who's missing from the room as well. So it's really highly related to empathy because you're noticing, even if the, obviously I'm not talking about a physical room, it might be, but it's more likely your team or the organization or the industry. You might have a room of people there or an organization where one part of it isn't speaking up. That's reading the room. You're noticing that those voices aren't being heard, or you're noticing they're not present at all. So leading with perspective is incredibly important, and it allows you to see a few steps ahead and really try and understand the implications of a decision as well. Now, curiosity was really strong for you, Lucy. So I reckon we should talk about curiosity, because I know that's one you're particularly interested in.
Yeah, because I just think that curiosity is like, we know it's good for us. Intellectually, we know that curiosity is a good thing. We know that it can even help with stress levels, right? You can't be curious and stressed out at the same time. We know that actually if we're going to thrive, then we need to be continually to look up and out. It's about, you know, that kind of growth mindset. It's, and yet some of us do it more than others. Why do we find curiosity hard, particularly to get more senior?
Terrifying statistic. 3,000 people were asked if they valued curiosity. 92% said yes. No surprise at all. We all think, you know, in theoretically, that curiosity is something we value. Only 24% of those people actually get to feel curious at work. So less than a quarter of us are actually experiencing any curiosity in what we do, which decreases after 6 months. Once you've been in a job, you lose 20% of the level of curiosity. So imagine if you've been in a job 5 years, 10 years, you know, you're barely even thinking about what bus to get to work or train, you know, you're just going through the motions.
It's interesting. I was chatting to the HR director at Standard Chartered, and she was talking about how they have diverted a lot of the investment of their leadership development away from the senior leaders and actually putting it into the emerging leaders, because they're more malleable. There's an intellectual hunger, there's curiosity there. And actually, instead of, you know, wasting in some cases a lot of money on very senior leaders who have got no curiosity, who are not engaging with it, they're really seeing a greater level of return on that investment with the emerging leader group.
And frankly, we wait too long to train our leaders anyway. The average length of time is 13 years from first
supervisor. Is that right?
So I'm very glad to hear that. But there's some
years before they get any development, by which time their habits are pretty much set. They feel that
they've already ruined the careers of 13 years worth of other people. So it's, you know, it's insane. So I think that's a fantastic idea. I think we should be giving leadership training as they walk in the door. New graduates should be getting leadership training right from the first day.
Well, you're ex-military, and that is, you know, the officer class. That's what happens, isn't it?
Well, for everyone, even for the non-commissioned officers,
really,
you're taught that you're a leader in your role, you know, within your colleagues, within your team or your unit, you're leading. But there's some key reasons we lose curiosity. So if you work in an environment that's a bureaucracy, that stifles curiosity. If, you know, you want, you've got a new idea of why we always done it like this, but to get that change, you've got to fill in 10 forms and speak to three committees and do a proposal and a new budget. You know, no one's got the energy to do that. If you work in an environment that isn't psychologically safe, so asking the dumb questions, if that's something that you don't feel you can do, then you're not going to be curious. And then my family have got a saying for me called mum's disease, which I know, don't you laugh, because I reckon you're going to fall into this too. And I have nothing wrong with me. I don't have a disease or anything like that. But I do have a tendency to hear the first part of something they're about to say and then automatically have thought of a solution. And worse, I've verbalized it before they've finished talking. Yeah. Now, that's making assumptions. And obviously, see, that's kryptonite for curiosity as well. You're not even listening to what the other person is saying.
My eldest daughter will continually remind me that I was actually just telling you how I was feeling. I didn't expect you to have come back with an 8-point plan of how to fix it.
Yeah. Well, I get
it.
Mum's disease in our house is when they'll start to tell me something and I assume it's going to be about problem A, but because I'm not listening, it's actually about problem B, C, D, or E. And I've just made an assumption of where it's going. So I think it's something all of us fall into doing. And, you know, as leaders, it's particularly damaging, I think, whether in your family or at work.
The other one I wanted to pick up was the humility, because this is something I think is really underrated for leaders. When I was at the BBC, we did some work around who were the best leaders, you know, that you, so it was kind of asking people who were being led, who were the leaders that you felt you did your best work for, who you really enjoyed working for. And these 50 names came up, and it was really interesting that, that when you looked at what it is that they did, so much of it was actually very basic human interaction stuff. Like, you know, they remembered my dog was ill and asked about it, or they don't take credit for my work. They say thank you, real basic stuff. But that humility was also in there and was very strong. You know, the ability to say sorry, the ability to say they don't know. And the greatest leaders I've worked for had the courage and the strength to be really, to show that humility. And again, I think it's a bit like curiosity, is that intellectually we might get it, but it can be so hard for us as leaders to show it. And yet the benefits are huge, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I am fascinated by humility because it's such a paradox. Like, it's hardly something you can say, yeah, I'm really humble. Just ask.
Like, it's such a not real top strength of mine.
Yeah. I'm incredibly humble. And in fact, on my scale, humility was number one. And so that's prompted me to do a deep dive into, okay, well, what does that mean? Because I don't, in some parts of my life, I'm not particularly humble at all, I don't think. And in fact, humility is one of the hardest attributes for us to self-assess. And the research shows that those who think they're humble, those who lead them probably don't agree, and vice versa. But what the scale measures is intellectual humility. And that resonates more for me. And that's where we accept that we don't know all the answers, that it's tied to curiosity, which means I'm curious because I know I don't know. And there's that intellectual humility and an understanding that some things are just beyond our control, having that perspective that we're just a small part of the world and things go wrong and we're not the center of the universe. All of that side of humility I find really, really interesting. But you're right, it's not a quality that we teach in leadership development courses even, because it's a concept that people are perceived, well, some perceive as to be a negative. And I think there's a lot of religious overtones that have been ingrained around the term humility. And it gives the false impression that it refers to being less than or being subservient, whereas humility is this incredible strength that you can bring to a situation. I also want to mention, when you said at the beginning you surveyed the leaders at BBC and some of those simple tasks like remembering the sick dog, to me they're not simple at all. They're so powerful, because as you were reading them I was thinking, that's empathy, you know, because you're really understanding that someone, it might not seem important, or that self-awareness of being remembering at someone's birthday and how they're going to feel if you remember. So I love hearing those stories. And you know, people,
but I think, you know, as an HR professional, I was kind of almost hoping that what would come back would be these, you know, Harvard Business Review level insights. And actually, of course, it was just incredibly human. Incredibly,
isn't it? It's beautiful.
So, couple of questions. When I looked at my scores and I saw all the, you know, kind of stronger on the heart side rather than the head side, I was wondering, is there a gender factor to this? Is there a gender bias element to this? Do women typically come out more on the heart side than the head?
You know, I'm so glad you asked, because we've just finished analysing the data, because we've now got such a big data set. I just looked, actually, we're just over 19,000. I fell into the cliche of thinking that more women would tend to be heart. There is no material difference whatsoever between men and women identifying.
That's actually really great news, isn't it?
Isn't it? So it debunks that idea that men or women, and remember, it's a self-assessment. So really what you're asking, or what we're learning, is that women don't see themselves as more of a head or a heart leader, and men don't see themselves as more a head or a heart leader. And then we looked at the top three attributes, and curiosity was number one for both men and women. And there were some slight variations on their second and third. Empathy figured for women and capability for men that was different. But really, it's marginal, no material difference. And like any researcher, I was at first disappointed, because I was hoping there was going to be this massive
big headline.
But in fact, the fact there is no material difference is really interesting in and of itself.
I think so. Yeah. And it will be interesting, I don't know if you've done that, but to look at kind of different cultures as well. You know, you were talking about the humility side, and is there
that's next kind of step dimension? So we're up to 115 countries. So I just need lots more entries from really different countries where there's only one person from, I don't know, Tonga.
Of course, you need your data.
Tonga, give me a lot more so that we can compare you to everyone.
So we'll
else.
Make sure we put the link to the assessment in the post. So a couple more questions and then we'll wrap it up, because I know that you've it's evening time for you, but you've got more meetings, and so we'll make sure we get you away. But how can HR professionals who are listening to this use this book to develop their leaders? Now, I know that you're saying that they are leaders too, and I absolutely get that. But let's say we've got some HR people listening who are thinking, how can we use this book as a tool to help our leaders develop? What would you say to kind of give them some tips about how to use it?
Yeah. Well, there's a big answer to that and a small answer. The big answer is, I'm now getting asked by organisations to come in and create this as a framework that they actually hire and fire and performance manage and do their leadership development programs around, so that we're actually actively saying to people, we want leaders in our organisation or employees that focus on leading with the head and the heart. So that is really exciting. The smaller answer, the more simple answer, is in the book, against each attribute, there's a whole section on how do I develop this in others. And it's designed to be really practical. So there's some really just fundamental ways that you can start encouraging those you lead, or the leaders that you are developing, how they can be thinking about others, and how they can, you know, really switch on to understanding that they will be better leaders if they create a whole family tree of leaders within them. I mean, that's really our job as leaders, is to create these generations of leaders that are to follow. But I realize for the HR profession, it takes a bit of work. It's not as easy as just telling someone that. But hopefully the book's a good starting point.
Absolutely. So what's next for you?
Well, this has gone, you know, bigger than I'd ever expected, which is wonderful. So of all those 60,000 leadership books, we've now got 60,001, and I'm going to add to the pile and do 60,002. Good just for you. In case. So I've got another book underway, and I'm now traveling the world speaking and working with organisations. So I'm loving it and hoping to catch up for another meal and celebratory drink with you in London or Australia.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, I'm hoping to be over in Australia later on next year, so hopefully we can meet up then. But it, as ever, has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us, Kirsten, and good luck with it all.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from Disruptive HR. If you want to find out how you can disrupt HR, then visit us at disruptivehr.com.